This is On the Other Hand. A podcast sponsored by Braver Angels in Arkansas, where we explore politics and other issues of importance to Arkansans through conversations with community leaders. Stay with us today as we talk to another leader in Arkansas who works across differences to get things done and to bring us closer together.
Well, we had a great conversation with Clark Tucker in our previous episode. We heard, about just because you're willing to work with someone on the other side, you don't have to give up what you believe, and learned a lot about his experience with working for the people versus just posturing for your own reelection. In this second episode, he's going to really go into more about the importance of focusing on our values and our common humanity rather than our differences, and how that might lead us to sometimes needing to compromise with other people. But really, the importance of focusing on what's good for the people of the state that you're serving.
You know, this gets down to one of the key things about political polarization, which is the kind of thing we're describing. It results in that tribalism versus values. It seems we're in a place now where it's really hard for people to be willing to be respectful and work toward common ground. Do you think that's true? And if so, what are some specific steps that we can take, you, society, us as an organization?
Yes, I do think that's true. There's a couple things that I want to mention, and I don't know that this is perfectly responsive to your question. If it's not, please follow up. But I think we need some democratic reform, little d. And to me, one of the major things that we need, because I think one of the major drivers for the divide that we have are primary elections, because most elections in the United States are determined by primaries, not by general elections. If you just take the U.S. Congress, for example, there's 435 seats. And how many competitive congressional races do we have every election cycle? About 40 or so, which means that we have 400 congressional districts that are either safe Democratic seats or safe Republican seats, in which case the election is the primary, not the general. And when that's the case, you have a political disincentive of working with the other side. And you have a political incentive to make sure that you're not going to be outflanked on the extreme. Because the only way you're going to lose re-election is by someone running either to your left if you're a Democrat or to your right if you're a Republican. And that's why we have gridlock in Washington, because we have 400 seats that are either safe Democratic or Republican seats, and all of those members have a political disincentive with working with members on the other side. And the same is true, largely in Arkansas. A lot of times my colleagues will say to me when we're working on a bill, my people don't want this. And whether they realize it or not, I think a lot of times what they mean is my primary voters don't want this, because that's who they represent, because that's who elects them. So there's no silver bullet, but to me, having an open primary system, I think, is something that would be very helpful on this. The way that this work that I file a constitutional amendment every legislative session for open primaries, and it always goes to the same place, which is exactly nowhere. But the way that it would work is when you show up to the ballot on primary day, you can vote for whoever you want. You can vote for a Democrat for governor and a Republican for attorney general if you want. And then the top two vote getters are on the ballot in November, no matter what party they're affiliated with. So you could have two Republicans on a ballot in a Republican district, or two Democrats in a Democratic district. And the result of that is that now the legislators are working for everyone in their district, because that's who votes for them, not just their primary voters. And I also think it will tend to moderate legislative bodies, because if you're, there are a lot of safe Republican seats for the state legislature in Arkansas right now. And if you have the same two candidates in the same two districts on primary day, only Republican primary voters are voting, which means probably the more extreme candidate will win. But if the same two candidates were on the ballot in November, then you would have those same Republican voters voting, but you would also have independent and Democratic voters voting. And a lot of them would likely support the candidate who's more willing to work with the other side. So we would end up, I don't know that that would change the partisan makeup necessarily of the Arkansas legislature a lot, but I think it would change the constitutional makeup of it in the sense that you would end up with more legislators who are more willing to work with people on the other side, and that would make a huge difference.
What's the hesitancy? I'm just curious. What's the hesitancy on approving something like that? Because that makes a lot of sense to me as an individual citizen.
Politicians are hesitant to change systems that got them elected. So that's, I think, it in a nutshell. There have been efforts to get an open primary system put on the ballot by a citizen-initiated constitutional amendment. In fact, it got enough signatures in 2020, but the Supreme Court kicked it off the ballot, which is a whole nother story. I disagreed with that decision. But I think if it were able to get on the ballot and the people of Arkansas were to vote on it, then a huge majority would feel as you do, April, and it would pass very easily. But like I said, political actors are tied to the system that got them where they are. So I don't think there's really ever a chance of it being a constitutional amendment that's referred to the people by the state legislature. But I also think it's important to keep it as an ongoing part of the conversation, which is why I file the bill every session, and I will next session again.
You know, it's interesting. I did not know that you'd filed that bill. That was one of those things I'd missed, I guess, because it kind of went into some dark place shortly after you filed it. But it just sounds like a really good idea. I agree with April. And actually, we've heard that from other people, and I'm hearing it more and more all the time. So maybe its time has come, but on the other hand, I'm also aware that the population at large, when you do polling on various issues, oftentimes what the majority of people believe, according to the polls, is not at all what happens when it comes to legislating. So I hope something happens with that. That sounds like a very healthy thing to do. Kind of a related thing here. This is me getting a little bit on a yes, soapbox, I guess, but one of the things that strikes me that really concerns me is this tendency to be really, it seems to me, really mean-spirited when you're campaigning and when you're governing, putting down the other side, exaggerating negative things about the other side, ignoring negative things about your own, and just portraying something in a way that's really unrealistic, if not totally fictional. And I understand that there's pressure to do that because it helps you get elected. I'm not naive in that sense, but I'm naive enough to think it would be really good if we could make it so that we don't reward that kind of behavior. And I wonder, there's this tension we've got to resolve between what you do to get elected and what you do to govern effectively. Any thoughts on how we can get people on both sides to balance those two perceived needs, because it would seem to be jeopardizing their own ability to get reelected. Any thoughts?
That goes back, I think, to the million-dollar question for us as a society that we were discussing earlier. Because, we really need our elected leaders to be leading us to a better place. And not that people get nostalgic over the past and they lionize it maybe more than it deserves. But I think for a long time in America, we had, especially, with presidents, they were trying to speak to the better angels of our nature. And that's not what we have with a lot of political leaders in America today. Instead, they're pulling us in the opposite direction by demonizing the other side. So to the extent, and I think it's inherent, in our DNA to be tribal, because, thousands of years ago that helped people survive.
That's right.
And it's really an evolved state of being to go beyond that and see the humanity in someone who's not in your tribe. But it's necessary, I think, for our survival as a country. But the problem is, I wish I could sit here and tell you what the answer is, but the problem is that right now we have a lot of political leaders in America who are creating a bigger rift between the so-called tribes by demonizing people on the other side. And I really think it's very dangerous for our country, and when our elected leaders, especially when they're governors or U.S. senators or presidents, you know, people suffer as a result of the language that they use in very real ways. And that's it's a major problem for our country.
And I agree with you. It seems like we're electing a lot of, I'm struggling about how to describe this. I want to say bad people, which sounds kind of naive, but people who do not have the best interests or the highest values at heart that's motivating them. Now, and I'm kind of in a way of just, okay, I can almost give up from them. That's probably not going to change. What really concerns me is the people who know better, and maybe in somewhere in their heart they want to do better, but for various reasons, pressure from their party, fear of not being reelected, are uncomfortable standing up and exercising leadership for what is right and what's best for the whole country. I've mentioned this before, and I hate to sound like a broken record, but it occurred to me one time, it's like we have a big part of our country that's devoted to keeping us safe and to defending our democratic republic and our Constitution, the military. They swear allegiance to that, and then they are willing to sacrifice in many ways, sometimes even up to their lives, to defend that. And it seems like they do a good job of, you know, walking the walk, you know, when they take that oath. Why can't it be more like that for people who are elected? We're not asking you to give your life or to be risking shot at, although some would question that these days. We're just asking you to say, if you risk not being reelected, at least stand up, because it's going to take a few leaders before something changes.
Yeah, no, I think that's an outstanding point. And, you know, I try to avoid partisan examples, but to me, the most obvious example of what we're talking about is when President Trump was president, and there are members of Congress, Republican members of Congress, who I know, beyond a shadow of a doubt, disagreed with the kinds of things that President Trump was doing, but wouldn't stand up and say so because they feared for their own reelection. Or they even said one thing on January 6th or January 7th, 2021, and then their conduct later is totally different from where they were on January 6th or 7th, 2021, because the political implications are different. And it's just very disheartening when you see people, and in some cases it's people that you know who are acting differently than you know what's in their heart. And it's tough to watch.
You know, it's one of the things that I think about, back to what you said earlier about the posturing versus working for the people. And even though their hearts might not be to be posturing, it's like the party elite might be forcing them almost to posture in order for the party to stay in office. I think there's so many different factors that could be influencing that. You know, one of the things that I think about in terms of Arkansas, you know, I think over the years we've actually had a lot of issues in which there have been bipartisan agreement or support. You talked about earlier on in the interviews about the values of Arkansans really probably haven't changed that much over the years, even though the partisanship has. And I'm curious about, you know, where you see there being potentially broad bipartisan support on issues that might could be things that we could work on to help the local Arkansan, the people of the state. You've mentioned a few earlier on the interview, but are there any that are kind of upcoming that you think might engender this kind of broad agreement?
Sure, I'll mention three or four, and I'll be quick so I don't drone on too long. But I think healthcare is an example that we had in the last decade, where Arkansas was one of only two southern states to expand Medicaid under the Affordable Care Act. And we had to do that with a 75% supermajority. So the other southern states couldn't get it done at 51%. And we got it done at 75%. And we led the nation in reducing the percentage of uninsured adults, which was a remarkable achievement. And we kept our rural hospitals open in the process. Now the rural hospitals are, they still have their own struggles, but I'm hopeful that everyone can come together and find a solution for that, like we did when we expanded Medicaid. I think literacy is another issue. You know, the LEARNS Act, which is highly controversial for a variety of reasons, most of which I agree with, but there was something in the LEARNS Act, which was a focus on literacy, that I think everyone can get behind, and I applaud the governor's focus on improving literacy in Arkansas. The third grade literacy rate is so important. Before you get to third grade, you're learning to read, and after that, you're reading to learn. And if you can't read, then you can't learn. And, you know, in some cases, folks estimate the number of prison beds that they're going to need in the future based on the third grade literacy rate. So I think starting at birth, with early childhood, and there's a program that I love and am heavily involved with called Dolly Parton's Imagination Library, starting with literacy at birth and focusing on literacy to make sure kids are reading at a third grade level when they get to third grade is something that we can all work together on. There are aspects, I think, of criminal justice reform that I think we can get together on. And I like to work on issues where you can appeal to people in a variety of different ways. But the reality is that locking people up and throwing away the key forever, it's just not effective. It makes people more likely to commit another crime when they get out, and it's also very expensive. So whatever your motivation is, whether it's treating people, even those who have committed crimes, you know, with dignity and respect, or what if your motivation is reducing crime in the future, or if your motivation is efficient spending of taxpayer dollars, then the solution is the same for all of them, which is let's be smart about how we incarcerate people and make sure that when they get out, the chances of them committing another crime are very low because they have the treatment that they need if they have an addiction or if they have a mental health concern, and that they have an opportunity to get a good paying job when they get out or whatever the case might be. And then the last example I'll mention, which is a very recent issue in Arkansas, of course, is government transparency. I know we'll talk more about this, and I'll kick it back over to y'all. But in the special session earlier, it was last month now, we're in October, but we saw a coalition of people from as far right as you can possibly get to as far left as you can possibly get to come together and stand up for the Freedom of Information Act and government transparency.
I'd love to hear more about how that happened, you know, how that coalition was built and you know, I don't know if you can share that without getting in trouble with your colleagues or not.
Sure. I'll say I don't want to betray any confidences, which I think is what you're getting at. And a lot, some, you know, much of it was public discussion. But when that bill was first introduced before we convened for the special session, I thought to myself, oh my gosh, this is another bill that I have huge fundamental disagreements with, and I'm worried that it will pass through, it will fly through the legislative process like so many other bills have before. That turned out not to be the case because the legislature stood up for itself, and we have three branches of government again in Arkansas, so that's a positive thing. And there were legislators on both sides of the aisle who said this is too far, this is going to be detrimental to the people having to an open and transparent government in Arkansas, which we've had since 1967, when Winthrop Rockefeller, and he considered that the signature piece of legislation from his 4 years as governor. And of the 135 legislators at the time, of course, he was a Republican governor, the first one in Arkansas since Reconstruction. And I don't know how many Democrats there were in the legislature in 1967, but I'm guessing about 132 out of 135, and there was not a single no vote on that bill. And of course, you know, it's been tinkered with over the years since, but we have one of the strongest Freedom of Information Acts in the country. And I want to keep it that way for as long as I have any ability to influence that. And so you had legislators on both sides of the aisle. And then not only that, but traditional FOIA advocates like the media, but also, you know, just people who are, who try to hold their local government's feet to the fire. In a lot of cases, that's good work. Sometimes I know it can be annoying for our mayors and city councils, but you have to have that check. You have to have that check. Otherwise, it's dangerous. And so we had people from all over the state, urban, rural, liberal, conservative. And I'm not just talking, like I said, a little liberal or a little conservative. But, I was having communications with folks from very conservative organizations like Conduit for Action or Tea Party organizations. And we were totally aligned when it came to government transparency. In the recent special session, I even made a joke that I was going to have a tea party for Tucker, a fundraiser, after the special session was over.
It sounds like the government transparency is one area where there can be some common ground. It has been found here. And I think I could see why, because, it might be in your party's interest if you're in power, but no one's in power for forever, whether people realize it or not. And so if the shoe's on the other foot, then all of a sudden it becomes very important. And I'm guessing that was part of the motivation on the part of people recognizing that it's in their best long-term interest, which of course, the long-term interest versus the short-term gain is another whole issue we haven't talked about. I think that's potentially important. But anyway, so related to that bill, I kind of was keeping up with how things went, and I was encouraged by the cross-partisan agreement on that. I noticed you got a little bit of hot water from folks on your left who are usually very much on your side, but there were some shots taken at you from the left side of the political aisle because you voted for that final very slimmed down bill. Could you kind of walk us through that? What's your explanation for why you did that? And, just kind of fill us in there.
Right. So that's the example I was referring to earlier when I said that was more of a compromise than it was a collaboration, because I ended up voting for a bill that I wasn't wild about. But it's because of the process that led to that point. I was in the trenches on that, both when the cameras were on and the committee that we were in, because the bill was coming through a committee that I serve on. And my Republican colleagues are used to me grilling them extensively when a piece of legislation comes through a committee that I'm on that I don't agree with. And they knew it was coming this time. And I was doing it when we were in committee. But even when we were not in committee, I was in the trenches working with the strong FOIA advocates in the state, like the Press Association, and other groups who are strong advocates for government transparency. And we knew what we were staring down, which was a bill that was really going to gut our FOIA law and government transparency in Arkansas. And we got to a point where we were able to cut out what, in my view, is about 90-95% of the bad stuff out of the bill. And we were left with about not 5% of the bill, which I still wasn't wild about, still don't like. But you have to make a decision at that point of, are you going to stand, are you just going to posture and vote no, or reach an agreement with the other side where, and in that case, you would end up with a bill that probably would have a lot more, in my view, bad substance in terms of gutting FOIA if I had just postured only and not reached an agreement with the folks on the other side. And so that's a choice that I made to compromise to get the bill whittled down as much as possible. But you're right, and after that happened, folks on social media were calling for my head. They were coming at me with pitchforks and everything else. And that's I accept that that's part of the job. And I think criticism of people's votes and elected officials is that should be part of the public discourse. But, a lot of the work that I'm describing was done off camera when I was in the trenches working with these groups. And I think the outcome was much better than it would have been without that work. And it never would have happened if I hadn't worked with, folks that I had disagreements with to get to that point.
Yeah, when you're talking about the 90-95% improvement improvement and then getting criticized for letting 5 or 10% slide. I mean, to me, that's one of the biggest problems we have these days, this letting the perfect be the enemy of the good. Or in my former field in psychology, we talk about all or none thinking being a very good recipe for depression and bad mental health and stuff. And so that seems to be going on more and more all the time. And so I'm really thinking that might be one of those examples of when you need compromises to move things forward, and that means you can't get everything you want. And it's not healthy for people to get everything they want, probably, truth be known.
If you will only settle for getting everything that you want, then why would people work with you in the future?
Exactly.
You know, I'll say this too, because this is another example where people are working together. I don't know when this is going to air. Hopefully it's released by the time this airs, but since that session, I've been working with a group of people to put together language for a constitutional amendment, essentially a Freedom of Information Act constitutional amendment. And I think people, I'm very pleased with the work that this group has done. I think people will be very supportive of it if it's able to get on the ballot. And I'm optimistic that it will be on the ballot. But to the point of this conversation, in that working group where we put together this language for the FOIA constitutional amendment, there are people on that group that I have fundamental disagreements with on other issues, huge disagreements with on other issues. But when it comes to government transparency, you know, we're all strong advocates for it, and we're working together in concert on this issue, you know, for the betterment of, you know, the future of our state.
Well, that's the nature of a democratic system of government. It's either that or pitchforks and guns. So, you know, you have to work with people that you might have major disagreements with. Okay, so let's kind of let April kind of finish up with us.
Well, Clark, it's been great to just learn a little bit more about you, and I wish all of our politicians had the value of working across the divide that I see you have, with focusing on what is good for the people, and not just you know, trying to always get reelected. I'm curious. I don't know if you are term limited out in your next term. I'm not sure what. How many more terms can you run for in this current office?
I can run for quite a few more, actually. The term limits for state senate, the situation is complicated because every 10 years, there's 2 4-year terms and 1 2-year term because of redistricting, and the 2-year terms don't count toward your term limits. So because of that, I could actually serve through either 2036 or 2038, depending on how the redistricting takes place.
Okay, well, this might be what you want to be doing for a while, unless you have future interest in other offices. Any interest in anything else?
That's a question I get frequently. And of course, I ran for Congress in 2018. But as of right now, I've got no plan to do anything else. The work that I do, as we've described, can be very challenging. It can be very hard. But at the same time, I believe strongly that I'm making a difference, and there are times when it can be very fulfilling. So I really think I'm where God wants me to be right now, if the people will continue to have me, of course, which is, of course, a huge part of that equation. And also, my kids graduate from high school in 28 and 30, and I just really want to be at home with them while they're at home. So, you know, I may never run for anything else again. I have no current plans, but for the foreseeable future, you know, if the people will continue to have me, then I'd like to continue serving where I am.
Well, you can see the values that you have even in your answer to that question. So appreciate that. Is there anything else that you would like our listeners to know as we end up this conversation?
Well, I just want to, first of all, thank y'all, April and Glenn, for having me, and Braver Angels at large for doing the work, because I think it's among the most important work that we need to be doing in our country right now for all of the reasons that we've discussed in the last hour. And I just want to thank the listeners of this podcast for caring enough about working with people who have different views to listen, you know, to this podcast on a regular basis. So I'm worried, very worried about the future of our country and the divide that we have. And you know, this, I don't know what the perfect answer is, but I know that the work that Braver Angels is doing is a key part of that answer. And so I just really want to express my appreciation to you, to the two of you, and to everyone involved for what you're doing.
Well, thank you. It's hard work. It's in the trenches, just like you were talking about your work, different way, but different trenches, but similar kinds of goals and outcomes.
Right.
Well, we really appreciate you coming on and being our guest today, and we really have enjoyed hearing your thoughts and the perspective that you shared with it.
And I was just thinking, I mean, you talked about being worried. We are. I mean, we are too. That's why we're doing what we're doing. Given all the negativity, we did have a little bit of encouragement about the cross-partisan cooperation on government transparency. Could you finish up? Is there any kind of like fun or funny story from your past or something interesting that just might kind of lift our spirits a bit?
There's one story from the first time I ran for office that comes to mind. I don't know that it's relevant to our subject matter. You know, I have some close friends who I really care about as people, and I know who care about me, you know, on the Republican side in the Senate, and, you know, of course, closer with some than others. But, you know, there's plenty of funny stories about that. But the story I'm going to tell is when I was running for office in 2014, I was out knocking on doors, which, of course, all candidates for the state legislature in Arkansas should be doing. And so I knocked on a door, and a lady answered, and she was an elderly lady, and she opened the door, and she had two dogs get out. And it's like these dogs had never been outside before in their lives, and they took off on a dead sprint. And I'm thinking, number one, I don't want this lady to lose her dogs. That would feel horrible.
Right.
But I'm also thinking, I can't, you know, that'd be terrible for me to let these dogs get away too, you know? So
there goes your door to door.
Yeah, right. So I start chasing these dogs, and it's one thing to run, to jog, you know. It's another thing to sprint, which is what I was having to do to try to track these dogs down. And then it's another thing to sprint up and down hills. And the neighborhood I was in was a very hilly area. So I was sprinting up and down hills for a long time. Ultimately, we got to a place where there was some construction work being done, and the construction workers helped me round these dogs up. And so anyway, I got one of the dogs. They didn't have leashes, you know, because they'd just been in the house. And I had to walk the dog back to the house, and my legs were completely shot. But I had to lean over because there was no leash, because I had my fingers around the dog's collar. And so I couldn't crab walk the whole way back. So I would take a few steps, leaned over where the dog could breathe, and then I would have to stand up for a few seconds so I could continue to walk, and the dog would, you know, be on its hind legs walking with me for a few seconds. So we get all the way back to the house, and, you know, I return the dogs, and the lady says, "Oh, thank you so much. I'm house sitting. I live in another part of the state. I didn't want to lose these dogs for their owner." So, so anyway, that was my door knocking for that day.
That's hilarious. Once again, his values come through, don't they, April?
Yes, absolutely do.
Thank you so much for being with us, Clark. It was just a pleasure.
Yeah, thank you all so much for having me.
We hope you enjoyed the second part of today's discussion with Clark Tucker. Be sure to check out the first part of this two-part conversation that we had with Clark, as well as other podcast episodes of On the Other Hand. And you can find those on the podcast page of the Braver Angels Arkansas website. And that's at arkansas.braverangels.org. You can also find us on many popular podcast sites.
And remember, when you go to that website, not only do we have links to all the previous episodes, as well as the second one for Clark, you'll find a link there where you could email us at otherhandar@gmail.com. That way you can give us feedback about the program or maybe suggest speakers or topics. We'd love to hear from you.
On the Other Hand is sponsored by Braver Angels in Arkansas. Music was composed by Randall Standridge of Jonesboro, Arkansas, and was performed by the University of Northern Colorado Symphonic Band, Dr. Richard Main, conductor. We also want to thank the Central Arkansas Library System's Roberts Library for use of their recording facility for this interview.
From your host, Glenn White,
and April Chatham Carpenter,
let's all work to bring our community closer together.